Very full shrine room, nice to see so many people. I'm sure some of you weren't here last week, so I hope it'll be all right for you to plunge into this week's talk. So last week we explored point one, which was train in the preliminaries. First of all, train in the preliminaries. So those are the four mind turnings, which we did very brief reflection on in the meditation. So sometimes these are called the preliminaries, sometimes they're called the foundations. And those four mind turnings are to reflect on our precious human birth, the free and well-endowed human birth with all our freedoms and opportunities for practice, which gives us confidence and generates appreciation and gratitude. Then to reflect on impermanence and death, that our life and our conditions are fragile. To reflect on actions and consequences, that what we do really matters. And then to reflect on the whole of conditioned existence. So turning our mind towards the Dharma, giving us a firm foundation of practice. So on that basis, we come to point two, the actual practice, which is to develop the two bodhicittas, absolute and relative bodhicitta. So we definitely need those foundations or a foundation for practice, because Chikawa's text says, at the beginning of this second point, having gained stability, reveal the mystery. Which is a very nice aphorism, isn't it? Having gained stability, reveal the mystery. Sometimes it's said, having gained stability, receive the secret teachings. But I quite like reveal the mystery. So the preliminaries, the foundational practices, are very crucial for giving us enough stability to be able to glimpse, or have a glimpse of a glimpse, I think as Bhante sometimes said, or even a glimpse of a glimmer of a glimpse of the transcendental. We need that kind of foundation of stability. So in the mind training teachings, that's provided by these reflections on the four mind turnings. It's good to reflect that, you know, we can add those to our practice, as you may have done over the last week, those of you who were here last week, but it's good to reflect that in our community here in the FWBO, we have a whole range of foundational practices. We have our practice of ethics, our meditation practices, our mindfulness, our metta. We have the Eightfold Path, we've got the practice of right livelihood, and we've got all the kind of conditions that are set up. We have friendship, devotional practices. So we've got a whole kind of mandala of very important practices, all of which give us stability, give us confidence, develop shraddha, give us integration, give us enough wholeness and integration and positivity to reveal the mystery, hopefully. So the mystery is the mystery of the absolute bodhicitta, the awakening mind, the mind bent on enlightenment. So Atisha, in his text, says, may I purify the untruth of duality into the space of voidness. May I purify the untruth of duality into the space of voidness. So the space of voidness or shunyata or emptiness. So absolute bodhicitta is truth in its profoundest and deepest sense, beyond concepts, beyond subject, beyond subject and object. It's completely non-dual. So may I purify the untruth of duality, the untrue dualistic world in which we live, into the space of voidness. So maybe it's good, before we plunge into the other aphorisms, to ask, what is bodhicitta? So bodhicitta is what makes a bodhisattva a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is someone training in enlightenment for all sentient beings, committed to the material and spiritual welfare of all sentient beings, willing to bring about their complete freedom, and also willing to undergo hardship and sacrifice to bring that about. So the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva ideal are the heart of Mahayana Buddhism. So Sangharakshita says of absolute bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta, it's the manifestation of, or the eruption within us, of something transcendental. The manifestation of, or the eruption within us, of something transcendental. The emergence within our own ordinary experience of something of a totally different nature. A profound transcendental experience which reorientates our whole being. A new note is struck, a new transcendental element is introduced. So that just gives a sense of what we're talking about, a little bit of an idea. So it manifests and it erupts, it's something completely other into our ordinary experience, but it's not a personal experience in any kind of egoic sense. There's one bodhicitta, there's only one bodhicitta, one absolute bodhicitta, in which we as individuals participate, or which manifests through us. So from that you can get a sense why Sangharakshita places so much emphasis on the fact that that experience is more likely to manifest or erupt in a spiritual community. Because it's not a personal, not something you can appropriate or own in any kind of egoic way. So he says it's more likely to manifest or erupt or express itself in a spiritual community engaged in intense friendship and encouragement. So it's not individual in a kind of egoic or personal sense which you can own, but on the other hand, you need to be as full an individual as you possibly can be in that spiritual community. It's of everybody present in whatever situation is as fully individual as they can be, practicing intensely together, communicating intensely together, practicing puja together, in order for this other factor, as it were, to erupt or manifest or be present. So it's not individual, it's not collective in a group sense, it's something other, it's something very hard to, impossible to describe or define. So it's expressed in one of the Mahayana Buddhist sutras in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha in a imaginative way. When 700 Lichavi youths approach the Buddha, and each youth, is it 700? 500, doesn't matter. 500 in the text, I think 500 youths come to see the Buddha in the Mahayana text, and they each offer him an individual parasol, which is made of the 7 precious gems. So they each offer him a parasol, and each parasol represents their individual aspiration towards enlightenment. So what the Buddha does is take all those parasols and magically conjure them into one enormous parasol, which covers the billion, million, trillion world systems and reflects within it the million, billion, trillion world systems. So you get a sense of the individual offering your individual aspiration and that being transformed by the Buddha into something which is not collective, not purely collective, but has unity and diversity, diversity and unity, because it reflects everything within it. So absolute bodhicitta is impossible to put into words, even though I'm going to have a bit of a go at it. It's impossible to be put into words because it's an experience, a state, even that isn't really true. It's something beyond all words, beyond all concepts. It's outside time and space. So Gampopa says it's of the nature of shunyata or emptiness. It's imbued with compassion. It is radiant and immaculate, unshakable and very bright, like the steady glow of a lamp on a calm night. It cannot be touched, soiled, or shaken. It transcends space and time. It is very mysterious. It is identical with reality itself. So you can see why Chikawa says, having gained stability, reveal the mystery. He leaves it at that, really, so maybe that's what one should do. And recently I was studying with Sangharakshita at Tiratnaloka on a community retreat, and we were studying the perfection of wisdom, the Ratnaguna Samchayagatha, and he was saying about wisdom or pranya that in some ways he preferred the term vidya as an expression of wisdom. So sometimes vidya has been defined as aesthetic appreciation of reality. And Bhante was saying that vidya has a slightly different connotation from pranya. Nya means to know, so pranya means to know reality, to know shunyata. But I suppose knowing has a kind of more intellectual sense, doesn't it, to it. Whereas he was saying vidya connotes the magical, the mysterious, the secret. And he thought that was more appropriate in talking about wisdom and talking about reality. And he said, for example, someone could ask you, or ask me, or ask him, what is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? What is the Buddha about? And you could give an explanation. You could say quite a lot about the Buddha, couldn't you? But then Bhante was saying, but have you really said anything about the Buddha's nature, the Buddha's enlightened mind, the Buddha's enlightened experience? Can you really say anything about that? So sometimes we think, because we got the concepts to hand, and we understand the concepts, that we understand what they're pointing to. And actually we don't, or we may have just a sense. So he was saying in the Pali Canon, there's a tendency to talk about the beyond and the way to the beyond. So the way is the path, and you're just going to something beyond, as it were, something mysterious and magical, something outside of your normal present experience and understanding, something which is in a way beyond, over the horizon, always receding. So it's a mystery. Where we're going to, as it were, or what we're going to reveal is a mystery, because it's not yet part of our experience. Although, in a way, there's a glimmer of that experience within us, otherwise we wouldn't be able to respond to it or be inspired by it. So absolute bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta, is of this nature. It's a mystery. So mostly in Mahayana sutras, it's described through images and metaphors. So Shantideva talks about the bodhicitta in images and metaphors, and other sutras, the Gandavyuha Sutra. So the bodhicitta is praised in hymns and said to be like the sun, like the full moon, like gold, like a treasure, like a jewel mine, supreme medicine, a wish-fulfilling gem, the mighty ocean, a powerful medicine, the sweetest song, a seed, an extraordinary jewel of the mind, a magic vase, supreme ambrosia, a wish-fulfilling cow. So it's just hymned and lauded through images, which are very, very beautiful. So that gives us a sense or a glimmer of absolute bodhicitta, reality itself, which is a mystery, which we can only kind of point at in some way. So relative bodhicitta is a little bit more comprehensible. That's truth, reality, absolute bodhicitta, manifesting in the stream of time, manifesting through individuals, manifesting in the web of conditioned existence, an active force in the world. So absolute bodhicitta is more of the nature of wisdom, and relative bodhicitta is more of the nature of compassion, you could say. And another image that Bhante uses is of the sun. So the sun is the bodhicitta, the sun shining on all sentient beings, the pure sunlight. And it shines through a number of different prisms. So the prisms are the bodhisattvas, or the novice bodhisattvas, or the beings. And as the white light of absolute bodhicitta shines on the prisms, the light is refracted into rainbow-coloured light. So that light is the expression in time, in our own lives, of our own bodhisattva aspirations. So how does it arise? How does this mysterious force manifest in the world, in us, in individuals? And again, it's mysterious. Shantideva says, it's like a blind man finding a jewel in a dung heap at night. So, he says, and even within me, this thought of enlightenment has arisen. So, like a blind man finding a jewel in the heap of dung at night. I suppose the heap of dung is, at night, is conditioned existence, in the middle of ignorance, as it were. A blind man finding a jewel. So the jewel is bodhicitta, but we don't really know what we're looking for. We've got some sense, so we're going somewhere. We've got faith, we've got shraddha, we've got intuition. But we don't really know what it is we're looking for until we experience it. So there's lots of stories in the Buddhist scriptures of at the point of enlightenment. I think Tsongkhapa himself, who wrote the poem we read, who was a fantastic practitioner. He, great scholar, great meditator, hundreds of retreats, hundreds of prostrations. You know, he really, really practiced. He really, really studied the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. But he said when he gained enlightenment, it was completely different from anything he'd expected. And you have those lines, don't you, from the Pali Canon, which say when people go for refuge, they say to the Buddha, it's just as a lamp shone in the darkness. It's just as if something was the wrong way up, was turned upright. So you get a sense of, you're drawn towards something, and you kind of have you have faith and an intuition towards it, but actually you get the sense that when the fullness of that experience arises, it's very different from anything you had known or could understand. So again, it's mysterious. Although it's wonderful and in a way unexpected, it doesn't arise completely by chance. It arises in dependence on conditions. So one can create stability, we can create causes and conditions for that experience to manifest. So there are many, many methods for engendering bodhicitta in the Mahayana scriptures. Bhante outlines collective practice and the sevenfold puja, and also following the six perfections. Other texts stress the exchange of self and other. Shantideva's great text stresses exchange of self and other, which we'll talk about later. Some texts, you reflect on the kindness that your mother showed you and your desire to see all beings as your mother and to repay that kindness. So there's lots of different methods for bringing about this reorientation of our being. So Atisha's verse says, by the gracious Lama's blessings, may I purify the untruth of duality into the space of voidness. So that's the generation of absolute bodhicitta. And remember, we're training in the two bodhicittas, as it were. And he goes on to say, and practice the profound exchange of my own and others' happiness and suffering, meditating continually on the two aspects of bodhicitta. So Atisha's verse is a bit like a prayer of aspiration. It's a very kind of brief, but it says, by the gracious Lama's blessing, so he's kind of receptive, he's calling on, you know, his Lama's teachings. May I. It's kind of a prayer of aspiration almost. Chikawa turns that into very pithy aphorisms, which we're going to look at next. So he begins by saying, again, having gained stability, reveal the mystery. So this is what we're trying to do, having gained stability, reveal the mystery. So his first aphorism is, consider or regard all phenomena as like a dream. Consider or regard all phenomena as like a dream. So this is a way, a reflection, to bring about a glimpse or a glimmer of absolute bodhicitta. So how does that work? So you can see why perhaps those four mind turnings are important, because we already reflected to some extent on impermanence and death. So you've had some training in reflection on impermanence. So here you're looking at all phenomena, which means everything out there, as it were, and your own thoughts, feelings, body, etc., and seeing that they're empty. Seeing that they're empty and insubstantial. So to do that, here you're using the dream analogy. So all phenomena are like a dream. So it's like a dream. It isn't actually a dream, it's like a dream. So I think that's interesting, because dreams are, when we're having them, sometimes we have lucid dreams, don't we? We know that we're dreaming. But when we wake up and we remember a dream, sometimes we remember dreams very fully, sometimes they just disappear, don't they? But when we remember a dream, in that moment when we wake up and remember the dream, it seems so, it can seem very, very real, can't it? It's been a whole drama enacted, many dramas sometimes. And in the dream state, you have a body, you use your senses, you hear things, you talk, you touch, you taste, you smell, maybe. it feels very, very real. All kinds of things happen. But when you wake up, you know, and dreams can be important in terms of you can interpret your dream and maybe they have meaning and so on, but you wake up and you realise that that wasn't real in this reality. Didn't actually happen. Those things didn't actually happen. Sometimes that's a great relief, isn't it? I had a couple of dreams a couple of weeks ago where I'd lost my credit card. I'm sure that meant something very significant, but, you know, and I was looking for it, you know, all night in my dreams, and I woke up with that kind of anxiety, you know, but then it was where it always was. So sometimes it's a relief. Sometimes it's a regret, isn't it? Something really nice has happened in your dream, and you wake up and it hasn't happened. Well, sort of happened in your dream reality. You know, you can fly, and in my dream sometimes I can swim, and I'm not a very good swimmer. You can do all sorts of things, can't you, that you can't normally do. Your dream body is very flexible, your dream reality. So regard all phenomena as like a dream. So that, I suppose the idea is that as you wake up from a dream, and that whole reality you can see hasn't got solidity in this world. You wake up from it. This world you can see as like a dream. Phenomena in it aren't substantial and real. They're impermanent and insubstantial. They're not the way we think they are. So you can imagine that you could wake up, as it were. I mean, I don't think you'd wake up somewhere else, but you'd wake up to that fact. You'd wake up that everything around you is impermanent. There's just a flow of experience. Nothing has substance, nothing has fixity. So you'd wake up to that. And you'd wake up to a different reality. You'd wake up to a reality without kind of craving and hatred, because in a polarized world, subject and object, we think of this as fixed to some extent. We think of phenomena as fixed to some extent, and what happens in between is often of the nature of craving or hatred, craving or aversion, which leads to all kind of suffering. So you wake up from that dream. You wake up into a non-dual reality. I think that's what this aphorism is getting at. In some ways, the same applies to time, doesn't it? Thinking about time and memory. You know, this moment is this moment, and then it's gone. And you look back over your life, and you know, sometimes, you know, what's happening now is what's happening now is so vivid and real, isn't it? And yet, you know, in 10 years' time, it'll be fading, it'll be lost. And the things that really, sometimes the things you got so caught up in, you look back and think, how did I get so caught up in that? So there's a sort of dreamlike quality even to time and memory. Now, when we were studying this with Sangharakshita, well, not this particularly, but the same thing was being said in the sutra we were studying, somebody said they didn't find it very helpful to regard all phenomena as like a dream, because they thought, well, if everything's a dream, why bother? What, you know, it kind of led them into nihilism, kind of nihilism and why botherism, but that's not the purpose of the reflection, to lead you into nihilism. So there are other images that are used to bring about this feeling that things are not as we normally think and feel about them. Images which have the sense of appearance and emptiness conjoined. A dream is one. Things appear in a dream, but they're not really substantial. So things like a mirage, an echo, a reflection in water, a reflection in a mirror, a rainbow, a dewdrop, all those kind of things, that they're there, but they're not really very solid. So that gives us a sense. The Diamond Sutra says, like a star at dawn, a bubble in a mountain stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, a dream. So should we view what is conditioned. So if the dream analogy doesn't work for you, then just try and think of some, you know, those other images. A rainbow is particularly kind of interesting, isn't it? Because a rainbow, you know, we're always excited. Well, I don't know if you are, but I know at Tiruvannamalai, there were lots of rainbows. We'd always rush out and look at rainbows if they were there, and they often were because it rained a lot and the sun shone. So rainbows are very interesting, aren't they? They're very beautiful, so they kind of attract us, and they're there, and they're incredibly vivid. But it's a refraction of light through water, isn't it? And, you know, when the conditions change, it fades. So it's not very solid. So that's the kind of a sense we're trying to have of phenomena, reality. That things appear, things definitely appear and have an effect. So there isn't nothing, there is appearance. But things don't appear in the way we think they appear, which is what some kind of inherent existence or substance or permanence. They don't appear like that. So that's the kind of sense we're trying to have. Appearance, emptiness, form, emptiness. Now, I think at this class, quite recently, there was a whole series of explorations of the Heart Sutra. So if you were at those, this idea of form and emptiness, emptiness is form. Things appear, but they're empty. They're empty, but they appear. So it's a kind of emptiness, appearance is a middle way between nihilism and eternalism. We tend to fall one or the other, even more subtly one or the other. It's quite profound to grasp form and emptiness, appearance, emptiness. So maybe in the weeks to come, think about mirages, echoes, reflections, rainbows, dewdrops, bubbles, and try and get a sense of that appearance, emptiness. And then maybe try and expand that or extend that to things that seem a little bit more solid, a little bit more solid. Are they really solid? So I think dream is an interesting analogy, though, because there's such a kind of world, isn't it? Such a world and a narrative and a story and an experience within it. So you know, just reflect on that, that one can wake up from a dream, it seems so real and so vivid, and yet it's gone. So we could wake up from our dream of a fixed subject in relation to a fixed object, we could wake up into non-dual reality. So consider all phenomena as like a dream. So the second aphorism is to examine the nature of unborn awareness. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. So it's as though we've looked out, even to our own thoughts and experiences, and now we're trying to look in to the mind itself, to the mind that perceives and experiences. Because you might think, okay, all that's empty, emptiness appearance, but I'm here, and I've got some kind of solidity and so on. Yes, you do have an empirical self, you do have experience, but you don't have anything fixed or substantial. So you're trying to look within the mind. And this is kind of, again, just remember we're trying to reveal the mystery, so it is all rather mysterious. So you're looking within the mind. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Examine the nature of your mind, of your awareness, of your perceiving. Look into it. And I think the famous text on this kind of exploration is Milarepa with the shepherd, isn't it? The shepherd search for mind, where the shepherd, young boy, comes to Milarepa and seems to be very bright, and Milarepa sends him off and says, well, you've got a mind. Go off and explore it. What's it like? Does it have colour, shape, smell, taste? Is it in your body, outside your body? What is it? So the shepherd goes off and falls into a very deep meditation for 7 days. So you probably need a lot of stability to reveal the mystery. And he comes back and he says lots of things about the nature of mind. He says, if you try and stop it, you can't. If you try and let it go, it stops. You know, if you can't control it, it's kind of elusive. He says it's lucid and limpid, it's clear. It doesn't have colour, shape, or characteristics. It's a flow. It's a flow of experience. So in trying to look at the mind, you're trying to do something quite peculiar, aren't you? You're trying to look at the mind with the mind. You have to fall into paradox here. So as soon as you think you've got it, you haven't, because then you've got the mind as an object, and the mind can't be an object. It's not an object like anything else. It's not like a chair or a table or a cup. It's consciousness itself. It's awareness itself. So how do you examine the nature of unborn awareness? How do you do it? You just have to sit and do lots of just sitting and bare awareness, pure awareness, and just let your mind settle. And sometimes you have a sense, don't you, of something deeper, something non-dual. You need another faculty. You can't look at the mind with the mind. You can't look at the mind as a subject looking at an object. Something else has to happen. And that faculty for experiencing mind, unborn awareness, is wisdom, is pranya. What can one say, really? These are very profound reflections. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. It's unborn because I think if you have a sense, if your mind does, as it were, stop, if it stops structuring in terms of subject and object, self and other, even for a moment, and we've all probably had glimmers of that experience, when that happens, you are outside time. It's as though that's the truth, and as it's the truth, that's always been the truth. You've always known that. This is why the Zen masters fall about laughing, isn't it? Kind of finally realise the truth, and it's just hysterical because, you know, they were so deluded before, and it's just very straightforward and ordinary in a way. What does it say in the Vajrasattva mantra? The laughter of the unchained mind echoes forever. So the kind of, I suppose it's bliss, joy arising, and that kind of freedom from subject-object. So examine the nature of unborn awareness. And Milarepa says, interestingly enough, to the shepherd, to continue to reveal the mystery of that, you need a basis in faith, you need humility, you need perseverance, you need understanding, you need the teaching. So you need a foundation, you need integration. But you can see what's happening. So you're looking out and trying to see impermanence, insubstantiality, and then you're kind of looking within, as it were, again. everything's flowing, nothing's fixed. Thoughts come and go, thoughts arise in dependence on condition, images, memories, everything arises in dependence on conditions. There's nothing fixed or solid. Experience is a flow. There's no I separate from experience, having or owning the experience. There's no object separate from the experience that has some kind of nature of its own that you know. All you know is what's within your flow of experience. So mind is often said to be to have three characteristics. It's empty like space, it's open or empty like space, with a sense of spaciousness, openness, shunyata, voidness. But it's not dead like space. It's imbued, it's vivid with awareness. Mind is always aware. It's a characteristic of mind. It's aware. And sometimes it's also said to be unimpeded. So everything happens within mind. Everything flows within mind. Sometimes the image of the ocean is used. So the mind is like a great and vast and deep, unfathomable ocean. It's vivid with awareness. It's like sun on the water. The water is illuminated by sunlight. And it's unimpeded. Everything manifests within mind. Like waves on the water, the waves aren't different from the water. So thoughts are manifestations of mind. Mind is empty, thoughts are empty. Okay, so emptiness of phenomena, emptiness of mind, just this flow of experience, free of subject-object solidity. Third aphorism. The remedy itself is free. The remedy itself self-liberates. So this is just a reminder that not to get hooked up on concepts. It has to be an experience. You have to have the stability to reveal the mystery. So if we make emptiness or shunyata or voidness, because we can use the word, if we make it into some kind of thing, we don't have the remedy anymore. Shunyata, openness, emptiness, is the remedy for all our troubles. That kind of open flow of experience. So if we make it something, we've lost the remedy. So, yeah, just let go. Just see the emptiness of phenomena, see the emptiness of mind. Just let go. Don't even think about emptiness anymore. Fourth aphorism, rest in the nature of everything. Rest in the nature of everything. Place your meditation on the foundation or the essence of all. Now, there isn't really a foundation, there isn't really an essence, and there isn't really an everything. It's just saying, really, that you're having this experience of openness, openness of phenomena, openness of mind. You're not holding on to concepts of emptiness, so you just relax into that experience. So you can imagine that, can't you? If you've woken up from the dream of fixed subject and object, you've woken up and the craving and hatred and aversion that goes with that and the delusion that goes with that, if you've woken up from that, that's your experience. That's deeply, deeply, deeply relaxing in a way. You just relax. There's no more tension. There's no more kind of polarity. In the Diamond Sutra, again, it says, the Bodhisattva stands on nothing whatsoever. Not on a concept, not on a skanda, wandering freely without a home. Just so, without a support, is the Bodhisattva standing, standing in emptiness. That's all you can say, really. So the fifth aphorism in developing absolute bodhicitta says, in the meditation break, be a child or a creator of illusion. So in this mind training teaching, some of these reflections are to be done, as it were, on the cushion. I mean, you can do them outside, but you can see with these very profound reflections that, you know, on the basis of a lot of meditation, the meditation retreat, something actually might percolate through. So some are done on the cushion, some are done in what's called post-meditation. You're trying to sort of blend your meditation experience with your life experience, not make it separate. So in the meditation break, be a child or a creator of illusion, which means take this sense of openness, of emptiness, of a flow of experience, of a lack of fixity in your everyday life. So try and just have a sense of that in your life. So very profound reflections on the nature of phenomena and mind and the results of that. But just remember that the aphorisms are trying to reveal a mystery. And we could just reflect quite simply on impermanence and insubstantiality. Now, some mind training texts do this. They start with the preliminaries and then say, having achieved stability, reveal the mystery. Some mind training texts put this section, development of bodhicitta, at the end of the whole text, because it is so profound, I suppose, and a sense that you use all the rest of the points in the mind training as a basis for that. Some texts put it here. It's like you've hardly done anything and then you're trying to reveal the mystery. I think both work from different points of view. From some points of view, it's quite good, isn't it, to have something that is just so beyond you early on. It's the path of irregular steps. I think the path of irregular steps is great. The path of regular steps is also great, but, you know, a glimpse of something, even though you don't really understand, I don't really understand, but something gets to me and I'm inspired, even by that term, reveal the mystery, that kind of gets me. If I do have a glimpse of that, or a glimpse of a glimpse, that's going to motivate me in my practice. That's what's going to take me forward, isn't it? That's going to keep me going through tough times, is that kind of glimpse, that vision, path of vision experience. On the basis of that, of course, you need lots and lots of paths of transformation to bring that vision into actuality, into your life. And I think it's quite good to have something that's just so beyond us that it just stops us in our tracks, as it were. And, it just can inspire us. So I chose to put it early on in the text, even though that might bamboozle us and all sorts of things. So, aphorisms for developing or reflecting on reality itself. So we're training in the two bodhicittas, so now comes a slightly easier bit, training in relative bodhicitta. So this is, as we've said, the mystery of reality manifesting in the world. Compassion, which Bhante calls the unseen flower, manifesting out of the mystery of shunyata. If we cease to grasp so tightly itself and other subject and object, compassion and empathy arises spontaneously. So the main method for developing relative bodhicitta in these texts is a practice called Tonglen. Tonglen means sending or letting go, tong, and taking or accepting, len. Tonglen. So sending or letting go or sending out is an expression of loving kindness or metta. Taking, accepting, taking in is an expression of compassion. So you're sending kindness, loving kindness, virtue, positivity. You're taking suffering. This is what the practice is about. And it's based very, very much on metta bhavana, karuna bhavana, the four brahmaviharas. So it's a method for exchanging self and other. It's a means of applied compassion based in metta. So remember that the purpose of this text is to reverse our basic attitude to self and other. So this tendency, well, I don't know if it's a tendency, it's more than a tendency, isn't it? To see ourselves as central in the universe is most important. Even if we don't have very good feelings about ourselves, anyway, that's what occupies our experience, isn't it? We occupy our experience. We occupy the centre of the universe as we see it. So we're trying to reorientate that towards other people, to understand that other people feel and suffer as we do. Other people are not just objects to us, they're subjects in their own right. Other people suffer, and out of that we feel empathy and compassion. So the Dharma says that all suffering arises through our self-grasping and our self-concern, something to reflect upon, and all happiness comes from cherishing others. This is Shantideva again. That's something one could just reflect on. Is that true in our experience? And Tonglen, the practice of Tonglen, is trying to bring that about, change that to self-grasping and bring about empathy towards others. The purpose of Tonglen as a practice, in a way, is to dissolve barriers between self and other. Dissolve barriers, open the heart. Be open-hearted, be compassionate, be generous, be empathic. So the first aphorism in training in relative bodhicitta is: practice a combination of both giving and sending alternately. These two should ride upon the breath. So Tonglen is giving and taking. I think the Tonglen means sending and taking. When you do the practice, first of all, you take, as it were. So on the basis of stability, on the basis of sometimes a sevenfold puja, a metta bhavana, you know, your heart is open, you take the suffering of the world. So it's quite a strong practice, very down-to-earth practical method, actually. So you have a sense of the suffering of all beings, the suffering of the world. You have a sense of it as like smoke, something sort of dark and heavy, contaminated. So you could, it's a visualization practice where you have, you imagine that, you look out over the six realms or however you want to do it, beings on the planet, and you just have a sense of all the suffering, and that suffering's kind of coming off them, as it were, or expressed by them as this kind of cloud of contaminated smoke. So it's suffering and its causes. And you breathe that in. You breathe it into your own body, your own heart. And you let it dissolve in your heart. It dissolves and reveals your heart, your metta, your compassion, your aspiration, which is already there. It reveals that. You breathe it in and then you breathe out. You breathe out loving kindness. You breathe out happiness and its causes to all those beings, like clear, refreshing, cool moonlight. So you breathe in this dark, heavy, contaminated smoke. You breathe out this beautiful, clear, refreshing, what moonlight's like, it's really beautiful, isn't it? Clear, refreshing, soft moonlight. And that moonlight carries all your virtues. You wish virtue, merit, health, spiritual happiness, worldly happiness, flowing outwards towards all sentient beings. It's a kind of inexhaustible fountain of positivity in this moonlight. So in, out. So doing the practice, you can first of all just get a sense of this cloud and the sense of the moonlight without putting it on the breath. You can just do it, just imagine it, and for several breaths and then breathe out. But the text says ride it on the breath. So the breath is an anchor for us, isn't it? We already do mindfulness of breathing, so we know how to work with our breath. The breath is an anchor. We always have it. It's a focus. So then we can breathe in, breathe out in this alternating way. Breathe in the suffering, breathe out the positivity. So, very strong practice, you might think. You might think, how can I do that? How can I breathe in all that suffering? I'll be overwhelmed. But in a way, it is the method for facing pain and suffering. That's what it's about. So often faced with pain, we don't want pain, do we? We don't want suffering. What do? We kind of tense up and close down and shut off. Or faced with the suffering of other people, we can either fall into despair, horrified anxiety, depression, all kinds of responses to that. We can close off in some way or other, which actually causes us more pain. So it's reversing that, as it were. You sit with this open heart, and often before you do a Tonglen practice, you do open yourself to your highest aspiration. Sometimes you can imagine a Buddha or Bodhisattva, perhaps Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, in your heart. So it's not just from you as an individual that you're breathing out your aspiration, your own kind of benefits and positivity. You're drawing on, in a way, your aspiration of absolute bodhicitta. You're drawing on that kind of wonderful awakening mind. So you won't be overwhelmed because you're kind of open. If you breathe in the suffering into your heart, and you reveal the mystery in your heart, which is your aspiration, you know, you relax, actually you relax, and your heart opens. And from that open heart you can give, you can breathe out. You have to try it and see. And we'll do a little bit next week in the meditation. So there's lots of different ways of doing this practice. It's very, very practical and down to earth. I mean, you can do it on the cushion, you can do it anywhere. You can be in a very difficult situation and you can feel yourself, you know, beginning to someone a bit kind of crazy on the bus next to you, and you can feel yourself kind of withdrawing. But you can just relax and breathe. Breathe in the Tonglen, breathe in that suffering, breathe out the moonlight. So lots of different ways of doing it. You can start in a general way, just getting a sense of the quality of suffering. And I think it may be in the Bodhicharya. I couldn't find it today, actually. Or maybe it's in the commentary on the Bodhicharya where Bhante says there is just a cloud of suffering. It doesn't really matter whose suffering it is. We just try and alleviate suffering. So you have this general sense of suffering in this dark cloud. And then you just have this general sense and the quality of the moonlight. And what does that feel like? How does that feel? then you can bring someone to mind. You can bring a close friend to mind, someone you know that you care about who's suffering, and you do the practice with them. So you breathe in their suffering. You wish them well. You can breathe in, I wish them to be free of suffering and its causes, whatever that suffering is. Maybe they're ill, maybe they're bereaved, maybe they're in sorrow. And you breathe out. You wish them well. You wish them to be free of suffering. And often what happens when you do that, when you start with an individual, is you also realise that there's so many other people who share that suffering. So you start to do it for more people. You start to do it more widely. You can work with the practice in the same way as you do the metta bhavana. You can start with yourself, a friend, a neutral person, a difficult person, everybody on the planet. Some practices suggest we start with our mother or someone who's really, really benefited us, someone who's given us, you know, given to us unconditionally. That may not always be true, and we don't have that easy relationship with our mothers, but there's somebody in our life probably who has given to us fairly unconditionally, and that person is suffering. How does that feel? You want to take that suffering from them. You want them to be happy. If you feel blocked in any way, if you feel resistant, if you feel uncomfortable, you just breathe that in. There's no way out of the Tonglen practice. Whatever you feel, you can kind of think, oh, okay, I'll breathe that in. I'll experience that. I won't shut off from it. I won't close down. I'll open to that feeling. And other people on the planet are feeling blocked, anxious, you know, finding it difficult to face suffering. So it kind of starts with something specific and often quite naturally moves out to more and more people. So, as I said, you can do the practice on the cushion, you can do it off the cushion. And if you want to find this practice in a text, lots of texts describe how to do the practice in more detail. So remember, it's a mind training practice. It may be that you have someone, a friend of yours who's ill, and you think, well, I can do, you know, that has an effect on you. Someone who's suffering that you're close to has an effect on you. And you do the Tonglen practice, and you have a hope that they'll get better. Well, they may not get better. You're doing it to train your mind, to train your mind so that you transform your blocks towards suffering, so that you can respond more creatively without horrified anxiety, without shutting down, without all those non-creative responses. You train your mind so that you will be able to respond more creatively when opportunity arises. And that has an effect on you, and that may well have an effect on others at some point. It may not bring about what you desire, but it's going to open your heart, and that's going to have an effect. So the aphorisms in this section are: practice a combination of both giving and sending alternately. These two should ride on the breath. And then the last one says, begin the sequence of sending and taking with yourself. So sometimes it's recommended that you do start with yourself, with your own feelings of suffering or pain or uncomfortableness, and then you move out. So the middle two aphorisms, the second one says, there are three objects, three poisons, and three sources of inspiration. And the three sources of inspiration are seeds of virtue. So here again, you're in post-meditation, as it were. So Tonglen, you're doing it on the cushion, or you're doing it in a situation, but you're kind of focusing on your breathing and on the taking and sending. Post-meditation, you look around you and you see there are three objects, and the three objects are, well, contact with objects brings about feelings of pleasure, pain, or neutrality or indifference. This is the Vedana. Pleasure, pain, indifference. And those have a tendency to change if we're not mindful or aware, from pleasure to craving, from pain to aversion, from indifference to ignorance, dull ignorance, indifference. So this aphorism saying, well, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, whatever we're feeling, we can always do Tonglen, or we can always take that in, the three poisons. If we're experiencing any of those poisons, rather than, you know, denying it or shutting off, we just open to that experience. We breathe it in and we breathe out the roots of goodness. We breathe out contentment, love and wisdom. So again, there's no escape, as it were, because you look around and you think, oh, well, other beings are experiencing pleasure, pain and indifference, and on the basis of that, they're experiencing craving, hatred and indifference. So you just apply your Tonglen practice to the whole of your life, basically. But it's interesting because it says in the three objects, the three poisons, and the three seeds of virtue. So you have this sense that within those three poisons are the seeds of virtue, because you transform them through your Tonglen practice. You don't shut off them, you open to that, and you send out those virtues. So the last aphorism says, remember this by repeated recollection. Use these aphorisms to train. You keep at it, remember them and keep at it. So at the end of a Tonglen practice, it's good to do it, you know, after a period of metta bhavana, then do maybe 5 minutes of that sort of breathing, and then you do imagine that all the beings that you've included in your practice are free from suffering. That's your imaginative experience. They're all, you know, they're all filled with moonlight, if you like. You imagine that, and you sit with that experience with sympathetic joy, with mudita. So that is point two, training the two bodhicittas. So having gained stability, reveal the mystery. Reveal the mystery of the emptiness of all phenomena, the emptiness of mind, the emptiness of emptiness. And on that basis, practice loving kindness, practice compassion through Tonglen. So that we dissolve the barriers, we open our hearts, and we cherish other beings at least as much as, or even more than ourselves. So I'm going to end with a quote from someone who translated a Perfection of Wisdom text. I can't remember his name. I think it's Lex Hickson, who says, paradoxically, and I think we're in the realm of paradox when we're in the mystery, paradoxically, the more radically the teachings of the Perfection of Wisdom removes from our view the slightest physical or metaphysical basis, the slightest substantial self or world, the more intensely we fall in love with living beings, regarding them all without exception as most precious, most beloved, and most intimately connected to our existence.